This episode is brought to you by Dietz and Watson.
Molly, it's time we have the talk about hot dogs.
Okay. Well, hey, I'm looking for a hot dog that's the real deal, Matthew.
Like a classic hot dog that, like, when you think of, like, the platonic ideal of a hot dog, I recommend Dietz and Watson's Dietz dogs.
Ah, well, I've heard that they're handcrafted and made using only Dietz and Watson premium meat.
I can vouch for this because Dietz and Watson sent us a big box of hot dogs and other delights, and wife of the show, Lori, and I had them for dinner last night. We had the classic beef Dietz dogs with toasted buns with sauerkraut and pickled jalapenos and Dietz and Watson ballpark-style yellow mustard.
Do you think you'd recommend Dietz and Watson hot dogs for fried rice?
Oh, yeah. Fried rice with some sliced hot dogs. I'm going to be doing that soon. Wife of the show, Lori, is going to be making the hot dog flour buns from Christina Cho's cookbook, Mooncakes and Milk Bread. Very excited for this.
And I'm especially pleased because Dietz and Watson does things the right way. So this means, like, no additives, no fillers, no artificial flavors, no cutting corners. You can feel good about this stuff.
Dietz and Watson. It's a family thing since 1939.
Shop now at dietzandwatson.com/the right way.
That's Dietz, D-I-E-T-Z, and watson.com/the right way.
I'm Molly.
And I'm Matthew.
And this is Spilled Milk, the show where we cook something delicious, eat it all, and we just finished it and you can't have any.
And today we are talking about the thing that we have just eaten all of, which is Japanese curry.
This episode was suggested by listener Vicky.
Thank you, listener Vicky.
And I'm just going to start right off by saying that the Japanese curry that I just ate here at your table was my second time ever eating Japanese curry. I believe the first time was also at your table.
Oh, okay.
So I have no memory lane.
All right.
Go right ahead.
When was the first time?
I don't know. You've cooked a lot of meals for me.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I remember having, yeah.
Okay. Well, I've got memory lane, so let's do it.
Great.
I know I've talked about this on the show before. When I was in sixth grade, my best friend was named Alex. His mom, Kuniko, was from Japan, and she would make curry for dinner, and I loved it. It was S&B golden curry from a box.
Mm-hmm.
And
I can totally picture the logo.
Uh-huh. And I just thought it was, like, one of the best things I'd ever had, and, like, immediately went home and asked my mom, like, if she would make it, and she, you know, asked Kuniko, like, how do you make it? And she said, get S&B golden curry in a box, and my mom did and started making it.
Oh, my gosh!
So this was, like, definitely, like, a formative food of my youth.
Mm-hmm.
And then more recently, like, I remember eating curry rice on ANA, like, flights to Japan, which is, like, pretty much the best airplane food you can make.
I have definitely had curry on a flight to or from Tokyo, of which I have taken two round trips.
Yeah. And, like, I mean, like, could you come up with anything better to be served as airline food? Like, it's, you know, it reheats perfectly. It's well spiced, so it doesn't, you know, suffer from, like, you can't taste anything at 36,000 feet. It's just perfect.
You know, it occurs to me, you know, for a few months now, Matthew, everyone has been talking about the Japanese show Old Enough.
Yes, I've been watching it. I've already seen a bunch of it, like, original in Japanese, because it's an old show.
Yeah, it's like more than like 30 years running or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, the first episode that they had on Netflix or wherever it was, we started watching it. The kid goes to the store to get to make curry for his dad. It's a sweet curry.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Is that, he starts to head home and forgets the curry and
precious.
Has to go back? I know. It's so
great. Yes. And you see him, like, he has to walk like a kilometer to get a kilometer home from the supermarket. And it's like along a busy street with these like massive trucks, and the camera like zooms in and you see him like as this little speck that slowly gets bigger and bigger next to this giant road. It's great.
The thing that I'm getting out of like rewatching the show, like watching a bunch of episodes in a row, is that 2-year-olds are so good at doing errands because they pretty much do what you tell them.
And then by the time they're 4 year
olds are terrible at it.
Oh my God. The kid who is like sent home from the orange or tangerine orchard to make juice. Yes. I was like, I'm going to kill this kid.
That sounds so great.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Because like a 4 year old will be like, oh wow, a stick. I'm going to play with this for the next 6 hours.
Well, but then the thing is like the mom is like calling him on the phone.
Yes.
And he just like hangs up on her and goes back to playing with his stuff.
Anyway. Yeah, no, it's just like, I feel like the way he answers the phone is like the way like I'm like, yeah, I'm getting to it. Like I'm about to do it. I was just getting started on that. Bye.
Okay.
All right. And then my other memory lane is, and we'll probably talk about this more on the episode, is the most popular curry chain in Japan is called Koko Ichibanya, or just Koko Ichi. It's become like a favorite place for my family and like a favorite fast food chain for a lot of people in Japan. But it was Teenager of the Show December's pick for lunch on their birthday the last time we were in Japan.
Delightful. Well, so, okay, tell me about this. The first time I ever heard the two words Japanese and curry next to each other, I was like, how does this happen?
Yeah.
So, tell me a story, Matthew.
It's a circuitous route, and it's a truly international dish. And a lot of the history that I'm going to share here comes from a great article in the Japan Times, which we'll link to by Makiko Ito, who's she runs the Just Bento blog and has published several Just Bento cookbooks.
Okay,
very very successful cookbook series, but writes a column for the Japan Times, which is the biggest English language newspaper in Japan, and. Curry came to Japan not directly from India, but from England. And that explains a lot about like how curry is prepared and served in Japan, although Japan has put a lot of its own touches on it, especially in terms of food technology.
Okay.
So
basically, okay.
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, the spices we call curry made their way to England from
the colonial era, going back to like the beginning of the 19th century, like curry began to grow in popularity in England and of course was adapted to English tastes. Like, mm-hmm. you know, whereas, you know, curry in India is a way of cooking and a style of dish that has hundreds, if not thousands of different variations, you know, in terms of geography and ingredients. And, you know, it's not one dish, but when it got to England, it was kind of edited down to like a couple of dishes.
Okay.
Right.
And so then it went to Japan.
And then it went to Japan near the beginning of the Meiji era. So like the 1870s.
Okay.
So like after Japan was forcibly opened up for trade.
Okay.
And so the British Navy and Merchant Marine brought curry and curry spices to Japan. And, you know, anywhere curry and curry style dishes land, it tends to be popular because it's really tasty,
uh-huh.
right? And because the ingredients you need are non-perishable.
Yes. Yes.
Like it's about, you know, you need like some cooking medium, which could be water and a blend of spices, and you can make curry.
I love the like game of telephone aspect of this, you know, like. You know, even just the aftertaste in my mouth after this Japanese curry, you know, if I ate it with my eyes closed, I would be like, vaguely like an Indian curry,
right.
But not quite. Like, it's like slightly altered in translation, or maybe a lot altered.
Yeah. And of course, it's great with rice, which was already a staple of the Japanese diet.
Okay.
So from when curry first appeared in Japan in the 1870s or so, it was immediately like became like a well-known dish pretty much, but was considered kind of like an expensive or difficult to make international dish.
Okay.
And that changed like through a series of innovations in like product, you know, technology and marketing.
Okay.
To the point that where today, spoiler alert, curry is the most popular food in Japan.
I mean, yeah, I think about you talking about Japanese sort of cafeteria food, basically, seems like a sea of curry and curry variations.
Yeah, and like other things with like not too dissimilar brown sauces also, and white sauces sometimes. Mm-hmm. So the main invention that made Japanese curry really what it is instant curry roux. So what the things that set Japanese curry apart are, like, first of all, like, rather than being like, you know, a profusion of different dishes, it's kind of just one dish. Like, they, you know, it comes in different like spice levels, and like, you know, different people like prefer like a lighter colored curry or like a thinner or thicker curry. But it's basically like heavily starch thickened, not super spicy, very smooth textured, and the ingredients, like, typically it'll be some kind of meat, like beef is probably the most popular, but it could be pork or chicken, and like potatoes and carrots or some other simple root vegetables.
I think of it, of Japanese curry, in all my extremely narrow experience, as having a certain sheen to it, which must come from that cornstarch.
Yeah, it's usually, I think, cornstarch or potato starch and flour, wheat flour.
Okay.
And so instant curry roux was a powder that was introduced by House Foods in 1926, which is still one of the biggest makers of curry, of curry mixes.
Wait, and, hold on. House Foods was based where?
In Japan.
Okay.
So it contains salt, MSG, some kind of starch, and spices all in one mix, and it can turn water, hot water, into curry.
Okay.
So that was started to make curry like affordable and approachable for home cooks in Japan. And then in 1956, S&B Foods introduced curry roux in bricks or blocks.
Okay.
And this is what most people use today and what I use to make the curry that we just ate.
So did they look kind of like bouillon cubes?
Yeah, I'll show you what it looks like. Not exactly.
Okay. And I love what you wrote here on the agenda, which I'm gonna steal and read and take your thunder here. You said, you know, that making curry roux or selling curry roux in bricks or blocks doesn't seem like a big innovation compared to just like a powder.
Right.
But if you think of it as like the difference between like Tide pods and a big old box of Tide powder that you got to scoop out, like the pods are way nicer to use.
Yeah. Like with blocks, like, you know, there's no mess, like, even possible. You don't really have to think about the proportions because there's like a recipe on the back of the box and it just tells you exactly how much water to use. We're going to open this and you can see what it looks like.
Hold on. Is that just one?
So this is a block.
Oh, that's one.
That can be, yeah, but you can break it into, it breaks into four pieces if you need to make a smaller amount.
Okay.
So, but this like block here is enough for like three dinner sized servings, I would say.
God, that
maybe
smells
four.
Great. It smells great. And it also smells like that, like concentrated, like food smell.
And this is the thing, like, this is a perfectly and highly engineered food product. Like, if you look at the ingredient list, it is long. And, you know, so it's got all kinds of like emulsifiers and stabilizers and stuff in it that gives it that, like, you know, perfect smooth sheen. And this is made by House Foods, like the company that originally marketed instant curry roux.
I'm fascinated. So this particular one is called Java curry. Do they make a number of different curries?
Yeah. So there's maybe like four that are the most popular. And then like in Japan, there are dozens and dozens of like different, like, you know, this is like our limited edition curry. And like there's become more of an interest in like real, quote, Indian curries. And there's been kind of overlap with like, you know, here's something that tastes a little more like what you might get in India, but is still in the format that you prefer.
Okay. I want to hear in a minute about how you chose this particular one. But let's keep walking our way through history. So we're up to 1956.
Okay. So
we've got the bricks or blocks.
1956.
Of curry roux.
Yeah. So now it became like super simple to make at home and just have it come out good every time. But it was still kind of thought of as like grown up food because it's spicy. Mm-hmm. And so in 1963, House Foods, same company again, introduced Vermont curry, which is either the first or second most popular brand now in Japan. And the marketing of Vermont curry was that it's a mild curry made with honey and apples, you know, just like you might get in Vermont.
Yep.
And it was marketed toward parents with children, like, you know, this is the curry that is mild enough for your kids to eat. And kids loved it and still do.
I wonder if this is the one that the little boy in Old Enough purchases, because he purchases a sweet curry.
I think probably yes.
Has like a apple.
Yeah, totally.
Thing. I'll hold my question.
Okay, and then one more, like, you know, nowadays, like, a lot of curry is bought, like, in retortable pouches, like, with like meat or vegetables.
What's a retortable pouch?
I don't know what that word means. I just wanted to say it because, I mean, it is accurate. That is what it's called. It's like, you know, like a shelf stable, like
a brick, airtight. Bricks? No, what's the packaging? We've talked about this. Tetra Pak.
Yeah. Kind of like Tetra Pak, only more like a bag.
Okay.
That, like, you know, it used to be called boil-in bag.
Okay.
But, like, it's like a pre-made curry that you could just, like, open up, like, microwave and put on rice.
Oh, like the, is it kind of like the, it was like a Korean pouch that you served us for lunch one day recently.
Yeah, it's like that Korean pouch that I served us.
Sounds like a weird kangaroo.
So that kind of brings us to where we are today. Like, curry is like super popular throughout Japan and is still like pretty much eaten like I made today. Like with usually with rice, and it's like a thick, dark brown, mildly spicy stew.
I have to say, there is something about the texture of it. It is, there's the shine of it and the gloopiness of it is different from a curry that I would have in an Indian restaurant or something. Yes. There is a gloop factor here.
Yeah. And curry is very associated with the Japanese Navy because they serve it every Friday on ships. And you can find lots and lots of recipes for, like, this is the authentic curry served by the Japanese Navy. So, like, I'm sure on TV in Japan, like, you could turn on the TV almost any day and see, like, a documentary segment about, like, you know, we went on a ship and ate curry with the sailors.
That sounds lovely.
I know. And it's like the one dish in Japan that everybody knows how to cook.
I like that. Yeah. Do we have a dish like that in the U.S.?
That's a good question. Like, I feel like the first dish I learned how to cook was scrambled eggs, but
I was going to say scrambled eggs seem like the basic, but that is not in any way like inherently American.
No.
I don't know. Anyway, okay. So what makes this different from Indian curries?
Yeah, I think it's the texture. It's the fact that it's there, you know, that it's, even though there are different kinds, like there's kind of one dish that is thought of as like, this is kind of Japanese curry that mm-hmm. everyone would recognize, which mm-hmm. is absolutely not true of curry in India. And that, I mean, the fact that it's not very spicy, I think is very characteristically Japanese. Like, I got, this is the Java curry that I got is considered like House Foods' spiciest curry. And I got the hot, and like, it was not very spicy.
No.
But very tasty.
The slurry, the sauce itself is really smooth. Like, it's very smooth, and there's a certain viscosity to it.
Yeah, and it's that proprietary starch blend that they use. It's really satisfying. So here's how I made this, which is basically exactly the recipe on the package, although I cooked the meat a little longer to make sure it was tender. So you brown some onions in oil. You add your meat and vegetables, if they're going to cook it for the same amount of time at the meat, I held the vegetables back.
What kind of meat did you use?
I used just a package of like beef for stew that was on sale at Safeway.
Great. Okay.
Then you put in water, and then you stew it, and you're making kind of like the world's worst stew because it has no salt. It's just water, onions, and meat. And then you take that, and then you throw it. I threw in potatoes and carrots a little later so they wouldn't overcook. Then once all the vegetables are cooked and tender, then you throw in the curry brick, and it transforms in over the course of about 5 minutes. Like, at first you think like there's nothing happening, and then like it starts to dissolve and the color starts to darken, and then the starch granules, you know, blow up and it thickens and like becomes curry just like over the course of 5 minutes.
I'm fascinated by the absence of any seasoning in the cooking water.
Yeah,
because you know, obviously this curry brick is massively flavorful, right?
Yes.
But like,
should we try like shaving off a little?
No,
and tasting
I don't want.
It?
Okay. I don't want to. You can do that later alone.
Oh, I will.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, of course you don't need to season it. You're about to pummel it with so much flavor.
No, but it does seem totally weird. It does seem weird. You know, when I'm making it, I will like taste like a bite of meat to make sure that it's like the tenderness that I'm looking for, and tasting like a, you know, water stew is pretty gross.
Yeah, I was gonna say I don't know if I'd be brave enough. I think I would just kind of pull it out and poke it.
Yeah.
So you served this today on white rice. Was it Calrose?
Calrose rice.
Okay.
And I mean, technically, I think it was Koshihikari.
Oh God.
And I served it like curry rice style, which usually you put the curry on one side and the rice on the other side.
I did notice.
You also have like a carré d'on where the curry is on top, but like side by side is by far the most common.
And then you took some sort of kind of rust colored, like little pickly type thing out of a can.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked about that. Rice. I think I forgot to put it on the, I put it on the agenda. So this is called Fukujinzuke, which is like seven lucky gods pickle.
Okay.
And I don't know.
Oh my God, it smells so good.
And forgot to research, like, how did this become like the official pickle that you serve with Japanese curry? But it is. And it's a soy sauce pickle of like root vegetables, usually like lotus root and daikon and flavored with shiso and sesame usually. And you can make it a bunch of different ways.
It smells like ginger too. It smells like fresh ginger.
I bet there's ginger in there. So I went to the M2M, the Korean market that opened near my house. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't know if they're going to have this. It's like it's a Japanese ingredient, which they do have a lot of Japanese groceries there. But like, I don't know if they'll have this specific pickle. Not only did they have it, they had it in Western Japanese style or Eastern Japanese style.
You are like so, I mean, I've never seen you so happy about anything.
I think the main difference is how much food coloring they use. And, okay. I got the one with more food coloring.
Okay, so like how it looks. Which one is this?
It's the Western style.
Okay. It is pretty. Does that generally get put on the rice? You put it on the rice.
It can be either.
Okay. And it's sweet. It's like
sweet. Or
it could
just be served on the side.
It's sweet and tangy.
Yeah.
But heavily sweet, I would say.
Yeah, it's supposed to be just like a little flavor and especially textural counterpoint, I think.
Okay.
Save big money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning Architectural Shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning shingles in-store and on Menards.com. And check out more of our great deals going on now.
Save big money at Menards.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
So in addition to serving it the way that you served it, what are the other ways that one might encounter Japanese curry?
Okay. There are three others that are really common. One is curry udon, which is exactly what it sounds like. You make a curry, and instead of serving it over or alongside rice, you use it as a sauce for udon noodles. And very tasty.
And so you would just take like plain, like boiled udon noodles. Yep. And would you put them like side by side in a bowl with the curry?
No, just toss it together like a spaghetti sauce.
Oh, that sounds like
it's very good.
I think that my family would like this a lot. Okay.
I will probably do that tomorrow for lunch.
Okay. Excellent.
Because we have plenty. Yeah, the thing about making Japanese curry, it's so easy to make, and like, you know, they sell when you buy a box of curry bricks, it's enough for kind of like 9 servings. And so I'll just make the whole thing because it keeps well in the fridge and it freezes. Mm-hmm. So
okay.
The other ways of serving are karepan, which is this is a thing like I think of it as like kind of uniquely Japanese. Like I don't know. There probably is like a version of this that originally is related to something in India or China. But it is kind of a filled fried dough that is panko crusted and filled with a pretty thick curry so that it doesn't like all leak out when you take a bite.
Okay.
And it's kind of crispy on the outside, but like it's got a lot of chew to the bread part. Okay. It's really tasty.
So it's like it's fried like a donut.
It's fried like a donut.
Donut filled with
curry.
Yeah, I mean,
it's shaped like a jelly donut, or it can be shaped like kind of like football shaped. Either way.
Okay.
And it's filled with curry. Very good. Oh, kids love these also.
That sounds fantastic.
Yep. And then the other one is soup curry, which I have never had. And this is a dish associated with Sapporo in Hokkaido, in northern Japan. And you do see it at like specialty soup curry restaurants, other places, but it's not very common outside of its home turf. And it's like a curried vegetable soup with a large amount of fresh vegetables, which sounds delicious. I've just happened to never try it.
Okay. And so does it ever get served with any, so, you know, we talked about these pickles.
Mm-hmm.
Does it commonly get served with anything else on it or
yeah.
near it? Is it like a side for anything else? What is it?
It is common to have curry with toppings. So if you go to Koko Ichiban or another curry restaurant, you will have a choice of like what toppings would you like with your curry. And you can go like it's considered kind of like, you know, everyone loves it, but like college student food, because you can quickly like build an enormous mountain of food that will not be super expensive.
Okay.
So like, you know, probably the most common dish at Koko Ichi is katsu curry udon. Katsu curry rice. I should say kare rice is how you say curry with rice.
Okay.
Like you don't use the Japanese word for rice. It's considered like a foreign dish. So you say rice.
Okay. So what you're describing here with katsu would have, so you'd have the rice, you'd have the curry on top, and then you'd have like a pork or chicken cutlet.
Yes. Exactly.
Like fried.
And usually kind of dropped on top, kind of like crossing the boundary between the curry and the rice.
Okay.
But you could get like fried shrimp on top. There's like a like crispy skin sautéed chicken that they have at Koko Ichiban that December and I both really love.
I can imagine that the saucy part of the curry would be delicious, like saucing this fried meat.
Yeah, it's really good.
Okay.
And curry rice is always eaten with a spoon, not chopsticks. For obvious reasons, because you would get to a point where it was not possible.
Okay.
And it's fun to eat with a spoon.
Okay.
I already kind of went through like my method for making curry. Like I like the House Foods Java curry because I feel like it's the most intensely flavored of the four or five most common curry boxes that they sell at Awajimaya.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always get the hot.
Is there a Java mild?
There's no Java mild, but there's Java medium.
Okay. I imagine Java medium is going to be quite mild.
Pretty mild, I
right?
think. Yeah. But, and then you get down to like, you know, the Vermont curry mild, like there will be absolutely no trace of capsaicin within a mile of the box.
Okay. So if I'm going to feed my child Japanese curry and knowing that my kid is like, my kid can totally tolerate spice.
Yeah.
Yet they are in this phase of thinking that they can't. So if they know that it's going to be, they're going to be.
Get S and B medium to start.
Okay. S and B medium.
Yeah.
Okay.
And when people in Japan make curry at home, like which they do like with curry from a box, probably 99 times out of 100, it is common to doctor it, to like put your own spin on it, and you know, feel like you're doing a little more home cooking in a couple of different ways. One is to mix different commercial boxes. Like, you know, some people say like my curry that I make at home is like, you know, 50% Java curry and 50% Kokumado curry. And
okay.
Like, you know, does this really make a difference? You know, sure, I guess. But like, you know, it's fun to mix things together.
Yes.
And the other thing people do is like, you know, put in like their secret ingredient. And the secret ingredient, like most commonly, is either cheese.
Okay.
And like a very like, you know, smooth, like processed cheese or like mild cheddar type of cheese.
And it would just melt in.
Totally melts in. Or chocolate.
I'm really interested in the cheese. I'm fascinated. I think this could be great.
Yeah, I mean, you can throw in like, you know, people throw in like, you know, like a Kraft single basically, or like some grated cheese. I have tried both of these additions like separately and together, and like neither one of them really does anything for me beyond just like the basic Java curry. But I would encourage everyone to try it because it might totally be your thing.
The Java curry, there is there's a sweetness to it.
Yeah, there always is.
Yeah, there's a sweetness that almost reminds me of like when I make bulgogi and I grate like Asian pear or something into the marinade. Like it's almost that kind of feeling.
Yeah.
It's like Like Asian pear or apple sweetness.
Totally.
Okay.
And the other thing I would say about making curry is like, one thing I like about it is that you put in a large amount of onions. Like it always, like if you don't feel like you're putting in too many onions when you're starting, then probably you need to use more. Like I'll put in like a pound of onions to a pound of meat typically.
And how much do you want to cook the onions?
You want to like cook them down a little bit and get a little bit of color on them before you put in the water.
Okay, cool.
But I mean, I think also everybody does it differently. And so like if you like less onion or like, you know, sweating your onion instead of like getting some brown on them, like, you know, whatever.
And so basically if people, you know, want to just be able to easily make curry the way that you do, you get the Java curry hot or House Foods Java curry hot.
Yep.
And then you follow the instructions on the box. Because the box says like,
oh, yeah,
this volume of onion, right?
Yeah, potato. Like, beef. One thing I love about the recipe on the box is it says 5 2/5 cups, 1,300.
Five and two-fifths?
Yeah, 1,300 milliliters of water or 1,150 milliliters if cooking in a covered pot.
Oh my God, I love this precision. Yeah.
They really make sure like you cannot screw this up.
Okay. Oh, I am here for it.
Yeah, and S&B curry, like the top brand, like is typically available in like your local like North American non-Japanese supermarket.
And are any of these Golden Curry?
Yeah, S&B Golden Curry. That's S&B the brand.
S&B Golden
name.
Curry. Yep. Yes. Okay. I know I can find this in my
absolutely
Western supermarket. Yeah. Okay.
So, and sometimes I make it in the Instant Pot. I did this one in the oven just because I had time and wanted to smell it while it was cooking, but it cooks real quick in the Instant Pot.
So wait, what part of it would you do? You'd simmer like all the stuff in the Instant Pot?
Yeah, when I do it in the Instant Pot, like I'll do like the meat for like 20 minutes, then throw in the vegetables and do like 5 more minutes with quick release, and then hit saute, throw in the curry brick and dissolve it.
Okay.
And it's done.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. One thing I always think about with curry is like when there's like a breakfast buffet at a hotel in Japan, there'll often be like a big tureen full of curry. Very satisfying.
That sounds really good.
Like maybe one of curry and one of miso soup.
Yeah. Ah. Okay. Okay. This was great. Thank you, Matthew.
Yeah. So haven't had Japanese curry or haven't made it at home or haven't had it in a while, like go out and make some. It's like the easiest thing, and it's always very satisfying.
I think Ash is going to be thrilled when I say that I'm going to make Japanese curry.
Excellent. Shall we move on to Now But Wow?
So, Matthew, on the agenda here, I only wrote one Now But Wow, but I actually have two, and I don't know if that's bad because, like, I'm using all my...
You're blowing your Now But Wad.
Yeah, I'm blowing my Now But Wad.
Yeah.
Okay, so they're both podcasts that I listened to yesterday. I have to set the scene for you.
Okay, set the scene.
So yesterday afternoon, it was really nice.
You're on your chaise lounge.
I mean, we're recording this episode like 6 weeks ahead, so it's late April here. And it's just starting to feel like when the sun is out, it feels really warm.
Yeah,
like on
I
your
just
skin.
Put rhubarb on the shopping list.
Yes. Okay. Well, so yesterday afternoon, so we had plans to go eat with some friends in their backyard. So I didn't have to like think about dinner. And it was like 4 o'clock and I was feeling sleepy, but like I hadn't really like done anything with my body all day. And I was like, I'm going to take a walk. And I went outside and I was like, no, I'm actually just going to get out like one of our camping chairs and sit in the sun in the driveway.
So when I said chaise longue, I wasn't far off.
Yes. So I took one of our like, you know, collapsible camping chairs and set it up in the driveway in the sun, which was waning by this point. I was wearing my puffer coat.
Uh-huh. Someone wrote a complaint about you on Nextdoor.
Yeah. Anyway, I put in my headphones and I listened to these two podcast episodes with the sun on my face. I think I even have a little bit of a sunburn today from it.
I don't see it.
Okay. Anyway. All right. So the first one that I want to mention is the podcast Partners, which is made by Hrishikesh Hirway, who is also the force behind Song Exploder.
And the Accept Cookies newsletter that I recommended a couple weeks
ago.
Yes.
And he did home cooking with Samin Nosrat during the pandemic lockdown. Anyway,
Partners is the kind of person who makes us feel bad about ourselves for not doing more stuff.
Thanks a lot, dude. Anyway, so this podcast is, you know, it's got that same wonderful production style as Song Exploder, mm-hmm. where like he comes on and he talks about why he's invited these guests, but then like he has this way of editing it so that he disappears right. and it's just the person he's interviewing, like talking.
Cool.
So anyway, this podcast is called Partners. And it is always two people who are partners of any type, whether business partners, romantic partners, whatever.
Partners in crime.
Partners in crime. He had Bonnie and Clyde.
That great episode.
Yep. Yeah. Anyway.
Ending kind of upsetting.
Anyway. But so the episode that I listened to was with Roxane Gay and her wife, Debbie Millman.
Okay.
And of course, Debbie Millman, you probably know from her own podcast, Design Matters.
Okay.
She's a fantastic interviewer. You know, the two of them, they're married, and they basically every set of partners who come on the podcast talk about like how they met. And like what their partnership is and what makes it work.
Can we get invited on this podcast?
I know, right?
Right.
Anyway, I have to say this episode with Roxane Gay and Debbie Millman is so like romantic.
Okay.
Just listening to the two of them talk and like how like hardcore Debbie like pursued Roxane. And also just listening to them talk. Anyway, it was it's delightful.
I'm in.
So, yeah, that's the podcast Partners made by Hrishikesh Hirway. And in particular, the episode with Roxane Gay and Debbie Millman.
Okay.
The other one I wanted to mention is an episode of Still Processing.
Okay.
Which is usually with Wesley Morris and Jenna Wortham.
Mm-hmm.
But Jenna Wortham is taking the year off to work on a book. And so Wesley Morris is having like a guest on each time to chat with him. And this particular episode is about theme music for TV shows.
Oh, okay.
And he's talking with Hanif Abdurraqib.
Yep.
And so they're having like,
as soon as you said theme music for TV shows, the Golden Girls theme jumped into my head.
I love that that's what jumped into your head. So they talk about, I just had never thought about theme music for TV shows the way they're talking about it.
All right.
And what prompted them to talk about it is, you know how when you're watching shows now, you can like click to skip the intro.
Mm-hmm.
And they were talking about whether like this is a good thing or not.
I've thought about this too.
So anyway, the episode is great. They talk about theme music from a lot of different shows, from Yellow Jackets to The Jeffersons. So like a broad range of time. Spoiler alert, Wesley Morris cries.
Okay.
It's such a great conversation. And it just made me think about like the experience of TV and the way that it is created for us in a different way than I'd ever thought of it before.
Okay, that sounds definitely, both of those sound like my kind of thing.
Yeah, so that's an episode of Still Processing that is, yeah, it's probably, it came out in March or April, and it is going to say something about theme music or theme songs in
okay.
the title.
No, you know what I'm going to do later today? I'm going to get out my chaise longue. I'm going to put on the song Chaise Longue by Wet Leg. And then after that, I'm going to set it up in the driveway of our building. I'm going to start listening to this podcast, and then I'm going to get run over by a neighbor trying to go into the garage.
Great. Okay. Perfect.
It's going to be a big day.
I'll come visit you in the hospital. I'll bring you Japanese curry.
Thank you. Way to bring it back around. So our producer is Abby Circatella.
That's right. And you can rate and review us everywhere you get your podcasts. I know all podcasts say that, and that's because it's actually important.
Yeah. Do we know why it's important? No. But we do know that it's important to hang out with other people who listen to Spilled Milk, and you can do that at reddit.com/r/everythingspilledmilk.
Indeed. Well, thank you for listening to Spilled Milk, the show that's...
the world's first retortable podcast.
You've been holding on to that one.
I just thought of it like 10 seconds ago.
Wow, okay. I'm Molly Weisenberg.
And I'm Matthew Amster Burton.
I did see, I had to open up an issue and look at this article, the headline of which was like 10 things to never ask your lover.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Let's go. Should we go through all 10?
Okay. So one of them was, have you ever felt this way before?
That's the whole question?
Like, yeah. Like, because you're not supposed to want to know if your partner has ever like been in love before.
Oh, okay.
Or, you know
I see.
What I mean?
Well, this is like more like deeper and more emotional than I was going to give Playboy credit for.
Another one of them was...
why did you do that?
No, another one was, did you come?
Okay.
Which I feel like, what? Who doesn't ask that of their partner?
I mean, that's that. I guess like this was like proto, like, you know, this, the number seven will shock you, like, because you do this all the time, but you shouldn't.
Yes.
Right.
But anyway, I do feel like probably in the reason that I'm talking about this is I do think that probably in one of those 150 plus Playboys, there is something about...
Is your soulmate.
No, there's something about how to like strengthen your penis.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, you know? Yeah, of course.
So that it can like withstand torque and things like that.
I'm going to go on the record here and say, like, I don't want mine to withstand torque.
Wow. I mean, have you asked? Maybe this is something you should ask your spouse. This was not one of the 10 questions you shouldn't ask.
Like do you want to apply torque?
Do you want to apply torque to my member?
Because torque is like a rotational thing, right? That's where, yeah. That's what gives me pause. Okay. But I mean, like, of course you do you. I'm just saying, like,
yeah,
like the idea of torque. Like, you know, in like under the hood, yeah, I want all the foot pounds of torque I can get. But under the covers.
You want a straight piston action.
Exactly. Like, yeah, we're talking about different parts of the engine.
Okay. God, I can't believe you and I managed to do a vaguely car bit for more than just one joke.
I know.
Wow.
I'm so
good
proud
job,
of us.
Okay.
Well,
too bad the world will probably never hear that.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.